Welcome to the Own Your Choices, Own Your Life podcast. I know you are here wanting to change and rewrite your story. You are desiring to step into the impact that you know you are here to create. I am here to guide you with the proven tools and strategies used by myself and our speakers to support you in taking radical responsibility in your life and learning how to own your choices to change your story. My name is Marcia Van Weinsberg. I am a storytelling business coach, master NLP trainer, speaker, podcaster, and 7 times published author. My clients have found freedom and purpose from overcoming their shame stories and learning how to share them with the world. I am so grateful you are here. Let's get started. Welcome back to the show. Today we are speaking with Liz Long. Liz is an author who has an unbelievable story. In 1968, her life took a tragic turn when a close family member, Linda White, went missing, pushing 6-year-old Liz into a shitstorm of epic proportions. 5 agonizing years later, Linda's body was discovered. Her case stands as one of Canada's longest unsolved crimes. At 58, Liz confronted her adult depression by checking into an inpatient treatment center for healing. With unwavering grit and a touch of humor, which she absolutely brings to the show, Liz untangled her complexities of her past, realizing that childhood coping mechanisms were never meant to be permanent. Now, at the forefront of mental health advocacy, Liz shares her journey and introduces the world to Victim Town through her book, Navigating Shitstorms, best title ever, How to Find Your True Path When Life Gets Rough. In this poignant narrative, she creates space like the Control Factory, the Guilt and Shame Cafe, the Denial Trails, and so much more, inspiring others to confront their own storms, discover resilience within, and find their way to Freedomville. We had such a really deep, powerful conversation. I love the analogies and the stories and what she shares here, because she is teaching you how to navigate the shitstorm of life and this shitty life circle that she talks about, with the standpoint of understanding that life is always happening to us. How we respond is what matters. That's literally what matters, is how we respond. So we went into some pretty deep conversations. She brings a ironic sense of humor to it, which I absolutely love. And I cannot wait to dive into her book and eventually meet her in person, which I know is coming. So have an incredible time listening to this episode. And I encourage you to, if this speaks to you, look at her book called Navigating Shitstorms. Welcome to the show today, Liz. I am thrilled to have you here and to have this conversation with you.
Thanks, Marcia. I'm really happy to be here. It's great to meet you.
We are Canadians, which doesn't always happen, right? I spend a lot of time talking to people from around the world. So you are a fellow Canadian as well.
I love that. Yes.
Yeah. On the other side of Canada right now. But we also realize we're not that far apart.
Yes, I grew up about an hour away from where you are.
Beautiful. Beautiful. So as a Canadian, that we are also in very similar age brackets, that we spoke a little bit about your early days of your story and what you experienced personally, your family. The reason I say that is that with that bracket in time that I'm referring to, there was a lot of talk of, like, we don't talk about things. We really kind of push it down. We don't feel it. We don't experience it. And I have a feeling that will lead into parts of you and your story. And I really want to dive into that. So tell us a little bit about where your journey started, Liz, and what the early parts of your story look like.
Yeah, thanks, Marcia. I don't have very many childhood memories. In fact, I have exactly 8 childhood memories, and one is fairly recently recovered. I was born in 1962, so I'm coming up to my champagne birthday. This month I will turn 62, born in 62. And in Burlington, Ontario, a suburban, safe town, when I was 6 years old, a close family member, she technically was my aunt, but we were more like sisters. She disappeared. She was 19. I was 6. And my mom stepped into the role of managing police detectives and everything that was happening. So our house became the hub and the crisis control center, if you will, for what went on for 5 years of not knowing if she was alive or dead. And it was those 5 years of not knowing that really had the biggest implications for a lot of people, for my family, for her friends. And I mean, I refer to it as collateral damage. I was six, I was a child, but I was living in the midst of that. So a few months after Linda disappeared, and my mom was pregnant at the time with a third child. I also have a younger brother. That baby was born prematurely and lived for a week, and then my sister died. And after that, my mom basically checked out of parenting and focused on holding her life together and managing the crisis at hand. Then when I was 11, her remains were found. And so we had that closure, at least. But it never ended. And it still isn't. It still hasn't ended. There's been a constant stream of new developments in DNA technology. There was new evidence discoveries. There were TV shows. There were books written. And today it stands as one of Canada's longest unsolved crimes.
That's what I thought when I was doing a little bit of back reading, that this is one of the longest standing unsolved crimes.
Yeah.
So if I can ask, when your aunt was found, was she near where your, like, was she near your vicinity or?
No. So Linda was last seen. She was in first year at Western University at London.
Okay.
So she was, she'd been there for about 6 weeks. It was November and she had just written a midterm exam. That was where she was last seen. And then her remains were found near St. William's. Yep. So out Simcoe, Lake Simcoe, direction. So about an hour outside of London.
That's a lot. That's a lot for any family. It really is. That's navigating that. And then I'm sure for your mom being even more, you know, having premature labor than losing a child, that just had to create, as you said, collateral damage. So when you say that there's a lot of memories that you don't have from that time, what do you remember?
I published in my book my each of my memories because they're so few, and unfortunately most of them are fairly traumatic. I know there's a lot of great memories in there too, and they are in there somewhere. I haven't been able to retrieve them yet. It's an interesting concept because when I was writing my book, I got in touch with a lot of family members, and we call those 5 years the Linda years, and without exception, every one of them has blocked those years out of their memory. Like there were aunts that didn't even remember or said that they didn't even know my mom was pregnant, that were shocked, you know, because they've blocked those years out as well. It was so traumatic for everybody. I remember my first memory is what I call the night of the wailing and hearing my mom with a guttural, you know, grief, crying out. After the realization that she hadn't just taken off somewhere for a couple of days. I remember evidence discoveries. I remember the police at my house. Most of my memories are not not fun.
It's like that's an experience to walk through. So it's actually really sad, but I understand in a sense that so many people had blocked out. Like you're also trying to survive. I think there's, I can't even fathom to understand what that experience is like because you're trying to survive with an unknown. Like it's not a sense where you lose somebody, you get to grieve them closure and have that. You have this unknown. This door that sits.
And that was the biggest challenge because the human brain, the imagination we have, can't not start imagining the most horrific occurrences of what might have happened to her or worse, what might still be happening to her every day, right? And so my grandmother, within a year, she literally was psychotic from the imaginations and the grief of not knowing. And then my grandfather had a massive stroke. And so then there was the crisis of having to deal with his health. And then we moved in with my grandparents when I was 9, so 3 years after Linda was missing. And they moved me into Linda's bedroom with all her stuff. It was like she'd gone away to university for the semester and was going to be back for a weekend.
I'm sorry for catching so startled. That just startled me. And I apologize for that.
That's okay. Yeah, it is startling when I think about it now.
Well, because we look at it also, like, just the concept of it, but looking at it through the eyes of a 9-year-old, I think that's the piece, is that being able to look at it through the eyes of the 9-year-old who's trying to process what's happening, processing adult reactions, right? Trying to understand what's going on, and also being 9. And it's like, that's a lot of different pieces there.
Right. Yeah. Yeah. And so that's one of my memories, is having boxes brought up there with my books and my things, and me opening the boxes and looking around and trying to figure out where I was going to put my things and what I was going to do with all of Linda's things, and not wanting to have to ask or upsetting everybody. You know, I mean, it's only in recent years that I've been able to go back and look at these things with a completely different perspective, because my entire life, and I didn't deny what happened in my childhood. I mean, I knew it all occurred. I just didn't think that it had any real relevance to the struggles I was having as an adult, to my depression, my drinking, my toxic relationships, you know, all of those issues that I was dealing with. I didn't think my childhood was responsible at all for any of those things. And I couldn't have been more wrong.
You're not alone in that. Most people don't. Like, they don't think that has anything to do with it. And yeah. It's so, I also want to clarify, because it's for people, it's not a sense of like blaming. It's just,
no.
Of course it has something to do with you're processing emotions and experiences and what you're doing, because you were learning a lot from those, during those formative years, and watching something very traumatic happen.
Yeah, exactly. And the coping mechanisms that I adopted, and the beliefs, the meanings about what was happening that I made up as a child in my head, you know, I dragged all that shit into my adult life, and it doesn't serve us, you know. But until we make that connection, and for me, it was in 2020 where everything caught up very quickly, and my depression really spiraled. I was suicidal, and I checked myself into a private rehab facility, and it was there where I excavated and examined and healed and worked through all that shit from my childhood, and understood how I ended up in the spot I was, right? And everybody was doing the best they could. I appreciate that today, you know, my mom, my dad, and everybody else along the way. I firmly believe that everybody always is doing the best they can, and here's the caveat, with the resources they have available at that moment, right? And for all of us, that there's a huge fluctuation in resources of patience, and it, not just time and money, but how much we love ourselves, that the energy, the strength, the courage that we have.
I love that you said that. I'm an NLP trainer, so I'm only going to say this from this context, in the sense that, like, one of the number one principles in NLP is that people are doing the best they can with the information, the resources that they have available. And I know that not everybody is going to see things that way, but that is something that lens has helped me. It also helps me to not hold on to anger and frustration on some things. But we're always doing the best we can with the resources that we have. there are points in our life where some of us are like, wait, I need more resources. I need to build my toolbox. And we go out actively looking for it. Not everybody wants to build their toolbox. Not everybody wants, and that's okay. Like this is, we get to look at it this way. So you have this lens that you're seeing now. That was going to be one of my questions that I wanted to ask is, I can see and visualize like you packing this backpack full of like, you know, challenge, trauma, push it down, collateral damage over and over. And you carry it and you keep carrying it and you carry it like a badge of honor and you carry it and you carry it and carry it. And then all of a sudden you hit a point where it's like, okay, I cannot carry this any longer. And this has to change. So that was 2020 for you.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. And yeah. That the first time where you were like, this, we've got to change how we do this?
Oh gosh, no. You know, I mean, the universe gives us so many chances to learn our lessons and figure things out. And when we don't, I think the ante gets upped a little bit and more opportunities are presented. I have had many failed relationships and I had bouts of depression. A serious bout a couple of years prior to that, bounced around houses, careers, you know, searching. And what I learned was that everything I was looking for was already within me. And it became a journey to learn to love myself.
That's beautiful. Everything. That you were looking for was already within you. And I think that is such a powerful message for everyone to, you know, we can learn things from outside of ourselves, which will only help amplify what we have, but we're not broken, right? We're not broken. It's available within us. But being able to see and heal some of those old experiences with a different lens, with a different perspective, can help us to move on. So here you are in 2020 and you are in a facility getting the support that you need. How long did it take while you were in there to have a few moments of like, oh, I have hope still. Like this is, I can definitely, you know, I can see now how all of my story has only added up to being like contributing to where I am right now. Was some of those realizations, were they fairly quickly? Did you have some of those realizations or what was that experience like for you?
The first week was a bit of a blur. It was so incredibly vulnerable and terrifying, to be honest. Mm-hmm. And I realized fairly quickly that there really was a connection between what my childhood experiences were and how I was. And then there was about a month of working through most of the pain around that. I mean, it's really hard. Nobody wants to feel pain. And I became a master at denial and shoving that shit down and locking it all up. I had all kinds of compartments and locks. And It took some time to gently open up all those doors and get that stuff out. And I was grateful to be able to do it in a very safe environment without external influences or other responsibilities. You know, the food was done for me. I mean, I had to do my laundry, but other than that, there was nothing as an inpatient therapy. There's nothing else to do except that work.
Well, it's almost like now is the time I can't avoid myself now. Like I'm actually, I get to face everything right now. And that's a beautiful point to be able to see like, okay, how can I help to heal myself so I can create change? How long were you there for? Can I ask?
I was there for 6 weeks and then I went to a stage 2 place that they had still in the same town. And so I could continue with my therapist on an outpatient basis for another couple of weeks. And then I went back home and spent a couple of months just integrating back into the real world and applying all the things I'd learned. And I mean, I became a, I don't want to say a different person because I'm not different. I became who I, the person that I always was that was hidden still.
So if you became, the person, if all of a sudden the shield, the armor, that was gone and you got to allow yourself to be seen. Was there a level of peace at that point where it was like, okay, there's nothing wrong with me. I'm actually like learning to love who I am.
Yeah, it's still a journey, you know? I mean, the learning to love ourselves, there's so many levels to that. There's, you know, just awareness, first of all, because figuring out who we really are, because we mask that. We want to fit in. We want to be what other people expect us to be. And so figuring out who we really are and then accepting that, because there's parts about me and versions of me that that maybe aren't acceptable to everybody else. So, you know, to accept who I really am and then to love that. And then the way I phrase it in my book is to learn to love ourselves without limits or conditions. Like that's the ultimate, because we can say, you know, yeah, I really like my body, just not in a bikini anymore. You know, like there's a limit or there's a condition. I like myself, but not if I'm really tired. I get cranky, you know, I don't like myself then. So it's all the parts. And I don't think anybody's totally there on that. I mean, I'm sure not, but I'm way further ahead than I ever was. So
I'm with you on that. I think if a person says that they do 100%, I'm like, I'm not sure that that's totally true. I think as humans, like I know I am much more compassionate and self-caring than I was probably even like in the last 2 years. I've learned so much more about it, and I've learned to respect what my needs are and listen as opposed to push and burn out nonstop. But it's been a life journey, and it's a slippery slope. Our subconscious mind's funny. I mean, if we spend our whole lives doing things one way, that's actually the automatic way. That's the easy way, is to fall back into old patterns. The hard thing is to do it differently.
Yeah, exactly. So I have this little diagram, and I call it the shitty life circle.
Love this.
And I talk about the voices in our head. And so there's the shitty voice that is the one that says to us, you know, you're not smart enough to do that. You're not good enough. They're going to laugh at you. They're going to say no. You know, you're going to crash and burn. And then there's the other voice that that's founded in love and not fear, that is reassuring and hopeful. And I call that our heart voice. So the thing I've learned about life is that we can never stop shit from happening. Shit is going to happen. And the trick, if you will, is to learn how to be a better responder. And the sweet spot is in that moment when shit happens, because we have a choice, and it's always a choice about which voice in our head we listen to, about which lens, which perspective we choose to adopt, about what it means, because we just make that shit up. We make meanings up in our head, right? And when we learn as a child that the world is unsafe and I'm not worthy and my needs are not important, then, as you said, those become our familiar, our default meanings and beliefs and the voice in our head, right? But we can disrupt that shitty life circle every time something happens, because we get to choose.
I realize we've just met, but trust me, anybody who's listening right now knows that, like, you're speaking my language. This is like literally my language, is the sense that, like, no one is immune from life happening. Like, shit happens to everyone. I say it all the time. It happens to everyone. I think walking through life expecting shit to not happen to you is when we get in trouble.
Of course. Yeah. Cause then you get sideswiped. And when it does, then you don't have the experience. You don't have the tools and tips and strategies to effectively manage it, right? Mm-hmm.
So you are in this space, you're talking about the shitty life circle, which I just absolutely love that analogy. I just have to say this. But take me through the point, where was the next turning point for you where you went, I think I actually am supposed to share these lessons. Like, I think I'm actually, like, that's different. It's one thing to, you know, put yourself into a facility to get the support and help that you need. And then as you continue to do that work on yourself, there's a turning point where it's like, I think I'm supposed to write a book, or I think I'm supposed to talk about this, and I think I'm actually supposed to be a voice for this kind of work. What was that turning point for you?
That turning point came shortly after I got back home. In reevaluating who I was and what I wanted, I realized that the current career I had was not a good fit. It wasn't passionate. It wasn't anything of interest to me. And I absolutely did not want to continue with that. And I felt, called, if you will, to share my story. And so the book, Navigating Shitstorms, How to Find Your True Path When Life Gets Rough, was born out of that. And I never aspired to be a writer. I didn't take journalism at school, but it came naturally and easy to me. And I thoroughly enjoyed the process of writing. It wasn't stressful. It wasn't arduous. And it came to me one night. And this fictitious world that I call Victim Town. Mm-hmm. And I describe it in my book. And Victim Town has places like the Guilt and Shame Cafe, the Denial Trails, the Control Factory, the Anger Gas Station, the Sorrow Swampland. And each of those places has a voice. And I've named that voice. At the Control Factory, where I worked most of my freaking life, that voice I call the boss. At the Guilt and Shame Cafe, it's the maitre d'. And those are the voices in our heads that are founded in fear, and they strive to ramp us up and keep us afraid. And the voice that talks back, because we all do have that internal conversation, right? The two voices in our head, and only one of those can truly be ours, is our heart voice, I call it. And we were all born with one. And that's the voice that has innate wisdom for what is uniquely right or best for ourselves. And yeah, so that it all just came to me, and the book unfolded. It took about a year to write. And then I decided that I wanted to do a lot of promotion for this and talk about this and become a mental health advocate. And for the first time, and I would have been like 61 when my book came out, kind of 60 when it was finished. And that process takes the whole thing, the publishing thing, takes a long time. But for the first time ever, it felt like this was my purpose. Like this was what I was truly meant to do. Yeah.
I cannot wait to read your book. I'm laughing and I'm loving the names and the descriptions and the visual, because anybody who has spent time in Victim Town.
Yes.
Brilliant. Anytime anyone who spent time in Victim Town, you know all of those small shops well. Spend time there. And I think we actually have to spend time there in order to decide that, wait, I'm actually not supposed to be in this town.
You nailed it, Marcia. I mean, visits to Victim Town are where they have gifts. All of those places have tremendous gifts to offer us, because it's in those places where we learn our most valuable life lessons. That is the only way. And so visiting there is not a problem, but the problems arise when we get stuck. When we get stuck there, depression sets in, addiction sets in. I mean, there's a whole host of problems that are in Victim Town. And my hope is that with this new language, if you will, around these places, and when people read the book, I mean, being called a victim or thinking yourself as a victim is people get their back up and it's like, no, that's not me. But my hope is that when people read what the voice in our head says in each of those places, they will see themselves there, mm-hmm. and they will have a new awareness about where they're hanging out. And we can't make any changes or do anything different or find a path to get out if we don't get really honest and real about where we're at first. And the other cool thing that was, it just happened, is that by naming these places and this new language, it makes it a lot less vulnerable to have conversations, to either share with people where we're at and what's going on in our world, or to ask questions and support other people that we know are having mental health struggles. You know, it's a little lighter to say, you know, yeah, I was hanging out at the Guilt and Shame Cafe all weekend. Wasn't a really good day. Then, you know, like, how do you say, you know, I'm really ashamed. Like, it's people have a hard time talking about it. So it helps to destigmatize it and promote conversations, which I love.
It's exactly what it does. You've actually, the other piece subconsciously, you might not even realize that you're done, which I think is beautiful, is that you are separating the identity from the mindset, the emotions. So,
oh, yeah.
You know what you're doing? So this is like, again, sorry, this is a subconscious and NLP piece.
Yeah.
You are literally like, you're separating the identity. So when I visit those places, it's like, oh, I'm just passing through. This is not who I am. Like, this is not a part of me anymore. But I can feel these feelings. There's nothing wrong with them, but they're not me. And I think that's the problem, is that the emotions, we're not taught how to process emotions. We're not even taught how to feel a lot of the time.
No.
And so when we feel these feelings, we assume, like, we take it as a label and we wear it. And it's like, I am shame. I am bad. I am guilt. And instead, by adding this visual to it that you're doing, it's such a shift in the sense of seeing that I'm just passing through. Like, this is something I'm allowed to experience this, but I'm not living here. I heard Lisa Nichols say this years ago. I have used it many times. It is not mine. And I love it, is the sense that you're going to drive through valleys. When you fall into a victim valley, you can slow down, you can stop the car, you can stay there, you might even pull up a tent for a night. But the second you actually buy property, pack, unpack, move in, now you're choosing to live there. You are there, your life will take you through that valley many times. But if you choose to stop, stay there, and build an identity there, that's a very different thing. And I think that's what you're doing in adding this visual to it that I think is really powerful. It is normalizing, as you say, and destigmatizing a lot of these emotions and experiences that we're all walking through. And instead of making them mean something about us, we could normalize them, that they're conversations and experiences that we're all feeling.
Yeah, absolutely. You know, Victim Town is a place that every single human cannot avoid.
No.
Yeah.
And I think that I personally feel that, again, we have to be in Victim Town to know that maybe we don't want to be there. And I also know that I can tell where a person is at in their point of creating change in their story based on where they are with Victim Town. I can say that honestly. I can, and it's not a judgment, it's just an observation. Yeah. I can tell. And I know, because I spend a lot of time there, I know that space really well. Like, I 100% do. The more I sit in Victim Town and the more I sit in that angry victim energy, there's no change that happens there. It fuels and we live in that space. And so is that a slippery slope for you to fall back into Victim Town? And how do you navigate yourself out faster or quicker, or what tools do you use?
Yeah. So, I love the way you phrase that. I mean, I had some go-to places in Victim Town for sure. And I think everybody has places that they gravitate to. And those are probably predetermined in our childhood somewhat. For me, it was the Control Factory and the Denial Trails. I've hiked so many miles on those trails. Mostly it's an awareness piece for me now. I still go there, but I know where I am fairly quickly. And what I like to encourage people, because I do get into the things that worked for me in my book, is that it's a really unique experience. And the wonderful thing is there are so many therapeutic, healing, modalities available today, is that I encourage people to stay curious and feel their way through what works best for them. Unfortunately, it's not a prescribed, you know, ABC, do this, and here's your path out of victim town. That's not the way it works. Everybody's route is going to be a little different with different detours and different challenges and different openings. I practice a lot of radical self-care. So it kind of depends on which place I've landed in victim town, what I do. I know the things that fill me up. You know, nature fills me up. I like going down to the ocean. I live in BC where the rainforests are so calming and beautiful. I like walking through the forests. I'm a big fan of meditation. That's probably my biggest daily habit. You know, everybody's going to approach what works for them a little bit differently. So that takes some intention and trial and error, right? But I think the awareness is the biggest piece when the voice is in your head and you can tell by the way you feel, right? Mm-hmm. Is to just feel. As hard as it is, you got to feel.
I know how much that's going to resonate with people because, again, this is, for a lot of us, it was not safe to feel.
Yeah.
It was not safe. And if there is a word that I have really learned to cultivate over the last couple of years is safety, and safety within myself to feel, to experience, to use my voice, to share those pieces. I would have never understood that the role safety played in understanding that within myself before. And I think that this is such a powerful conversation. I'm curious, with the work that you do, what has the ripple effect been within your family, either way, with the work that you're doing now?
You know, it's so interesting. With my family and friends, so there definitely have been some people that have fallen away, dropped off, and I think that's an inevitable occurrence when we grow, when we change, when we become different. Mm-hmm. As well, there have also been new people that have come into my world, and they're very different than the people that have fallen away. From an energetic standpoint, I think that I have two adult boys. They are now 32 and 34 almost. I no longer drink alcohol. Mm-hmm. And I didn't identify as an alcoholic when I checked myself in, but I was certainly on that trajectory, drinking more than I should. It was a coping mechanism of mine and of the majority of population in North America, I believe.
Way more than we think. Yes.
Yep. Yeah. So I no longer drink alcohol. And one of my oldest doesn't drink at all. My oldest doesn't drink at all. And the other one drinks very minimally. So, and I'm not out there touting, you know, I mean, as a mother or as an ex-smoker, you know, it's not helpful to, that's the control factory, to be telling people what they should do. So I don't do that at all anymore. But I think that just leading by example has shifted things for other people as well. Mm-hmm. My family, I'm very close to my family, but I don't have a lot of them geographically close mm-hmm. to me. They're certainly proud of my work. And the secondary purpose, not purpose or hope, if you will, of my book. First and foremost, it's a mental health self-help book. And I want to help people become aware of the voices in their head and where they're at and give them some inspiration, encouragement, and some guidance toward getting out of victim town to the place that I refer to as Freedomville. So that's the choice, victim town or Freedomville. But everybody does that when they're ready to do it. You know, you can't push or pull or cajole or drag people out. So
That's a big point, and I'm glad that you said that because it is, I know I've spent a lot of time. You called it Control Factory?
Yeah.
The Control Factory. I ran that place for a while.
Yeah.
I ran.
Right?
Yep. Uh-huh. And I'm loving these names because I'm such a visual. It's so simple and I love it. But we also can't make things happen for other people. Like, and really, we have to spend that time and energy on ourselves. That's what's going to create the change. And then sometimes we end up being, it's not that it happens because of us, but we create permission for other people to create change in their lives because they're seeing firsthand. Like, it's not a case of you telling people what to do. They get to watch sometimes through you how your life has changed. Yeah. You're different, right? Like, you are leading yourself. Yeah.
I am. And it's not without its challenges. I mean, we talked about this before. Shit still happens. Shit still happens to me. And it will. I just have a different perspective about it now. And it's just a lot more relaxed and trusting. So I teach what I call intrinsic courage. And it's a challenge for me to teach that. It holds me accountable. And sometimes it's really freaking hard. So the definition I have for intrinsic courage is our ability to view every past experience and every current situation and every person involved with compassion and love. And every person includes ourselves.
It does.
And I think it's, for me anyways, it's a lot easier to have compassion and forgive other people than it is for me to do that myself, right? I mean, I raised my boys as a single mom and I was very unhealed. Mm-hmm. I hadn't dealt with any of this. So I look back and, you know, I can't not have some regrets knowing what I know now about things I did and, you know, how all that went down. And at the same time, I also appreciate now and understand that that was my journey and that that was also my boy's journey. Right. And that's for them. Right. Some of the stuff we laugh about.
But I think that this is a really key important piece is, and I want to say this in a sense that, you know, we look at it and say, like, are we doing the best that we can with the information that we have at the time? Yes.
Right. Right.
And it's not about perfection, but it's recognizing that. And as you said earlier, you know, knowing that your family did the best that they could with the information, the resources that they had at the time, you also did the same. But as you're doing this work and this healing, adding a voice, speaking about it, you are creating change subconsciously, even in your boys, because they are seeing you lead yourself differently. Again, not perfection, but I say this all the time. Did I make mistakes with my own kids? Absolutely. Did I do the best?
Does.
Yeah. Like, but I do think though that there is a culture and an environment. I think that's safe to say this. I have a lot of friends who are young and have kids or babies or are pregnant. And there's this, you know, need to do it all perfectly, to like sit all the boxes and to do that. I'm like, you need to let that go and faster than you think you do, like, because it's not going to happen. But as long as you can always look back and say, like, did I do the best that I could at that point in time? And I believe that as humans, most of us, we can say that, yes, we are. Like, we are doing the best that we can. I said that with my own kids as they got older. I'm like, I look back and there's things I would do differently. But you didn't come with a manual. And if you did, there was no manual for what we walked through at all. So I did the best that I could at the time. And I honor the fact that I did try as hard as I could with what we were experiencing. So I really feel like there's that piece of self-compassion, that intrinsic courage. I absolutely love that definition and how you shared that. I think that's a really important piece. And, you know, whatever we resist for most of our life is probably what we end up really needing the most. And compassion? Are you kidding me? I have no time for that. I got no time for that. I got stuff to do. And now it's like, oh no, I definitely need more of that. Like those are some of the pieces of it. So I appreciate you sharing all of that. Now your book, Navigating Shitstorms, where can we find it? Where is it? Is it everywhere? Just curious.
Yeah, it's I have a U.S. publisher right now. There's a bit of a glitch with Amazon Canada, so trying to sort that out. But it's at Indigo, Kindle, Audible as well.
Oh, Audible, good for you.
Yeah, Barnes & Noble, Amazon.com. Yeah, it's in awesome. All the places.
Awesome. I cannot wait to take a listen to it and be able to share that out. The work that you're doing, what's next for you? What do you see on the horizon?
I'm in the process of creating a guidebook that will take the concepts and the places of Victim Town and help readers apply those and work through, reflect as they relate to themselves and their own life. So that hopefully will be to market in the next couple of months. Mm-hmm. And I'm considering public speaking. I haven't done it, so I'm going to try it out. And if I love it, then I will do more of it. Yeah. Oh, and maybe another book. We'll see.
Look at this. So a reminder for anybody who is listening, right? And I'm sure you can relate to this. We're never too old to do anything. Like, we can do, and because I know for a long time, there was a point in my 40s where I was like, oh, I have to have this figured out by this time. And now it's like, I just celebrated a birthday and I'm like, you know what? 54, I own that. I'm happy with that. I'm grateful for all the things that I do. And half the things I do now, I wasn't even doing before my 50s. So there's so much time, like not so much time. There's no shortage of time to be able to like go out and create and do the work that you feel you are here to do.
Yeah, absolutely. And thanks, Marcia, because that is part of my messaging, is that it is never too late. Mm-mm. And to also appreciate that we are all in the right place at the right time, doing the right thing. You know, the voice in our head that tells us otherwise, that's the boss from the control factory saying, you know, yeah, you're 35 and you don't own a house yet. You know, you should be married. You should own real estate. You should. Yeah, she's a liar.
She's a liar. Do you ever have moments when, and I just want to ask you honestly, do you ever have moments when, you know, you see that quote that you're exactly where you're supposed to be? Do you ever have like a sliver of a moment where it's like, or is it always like, yep, I 100% trust that?
No, of course I still have those moments.
Yeah.
Oh my God. Yeah. Yeah. Human. Yeah. And I was like, what? Like here, this now? Come on. Really? Come on.
I had to say
not
it
fair.
And I had to ask
not
it.
Fair.
I
did. Right? Yes. Well,
I see those quotes and I'm like, oh, and I'm like, no, okay, you're exactly where you need. Like, it's just those moments. Or I have a lot of clients who might be in their 20s or early 30s and they're like, I feel so late to the game. I feel so old. I'm like, oh my God, suck it up. Like double your age. But I also have a good sense of humor with it. And I just recognize those are normal feelings.
Yeah, they are. They are. And that's the life circle. So that's the shit happening, whatever it is that's going on, and the opportunity that we have to choose the meaning, that to choose the perspective around which we use to view whatever it is we're experiencing. Because that shitty life circle loop is not a lot of fun. That's what keeps us in victim town. But the other one is, when shit happens, is that we listen to our heart voice instead, the one that is founded in love, that knows intuitively that everything will work out, right? And when we listen to that voice and adopt healthy coping mechanisms, then we're on a path to Freedomville. I mean, that leaps around too, because guess what? The shit happens is the explosion in the middle of this diagram, right? Mm-hmm. But that's the choice point. So that's the choice point.
I have a question on this, and I love this explanation. Quick question. If you're in victim town, can you hear your heart voice, or do you need to?
Yes. Move? So okay. Yes, you can. And part of my teachings in my book are what I call the heart voice power plan, and the things that we can do to hear it. Because some people may say, well, I don't have that voice, or the other voices are so loud, right? So I do address that, how to hear it more often, how to entice it to be louder, and how to have the courage to to listen to it and to act on what that voice is saying. And I mean, it's a learning. It's a learning process. There is one place in Victim Town where there is a reprieve. It's the Meditation Meadow. And I put the Meditation Meadow in Victim Town because to meditate, and it sounds ominous and people get all, you know, freaked out about it. I can't do it. I can't sit quietly. It's the purpose of meditation is not to get good at meditation. It's to tap into your heart voice. And we can do that wherever, whenever, with no additional resources required. We can look inward and just get quiet and hear our heart voice. So the Meditation Meadow exists in Victim Town. Otherwise, all the other places are chaotic and painful and fearful and decidedly quite yucky once you know about them.
I'm so glad I asked that question, because I know somebody will resonate and connect to is, you know, I can't hear my heart voice. I can't hear my intuition. That's easy for you because of this. I'm like, no, it's a muscle. You have to learn how to connect to that and listen to it. And then you create this positive loop feedback that it's like, no, I do know the answer. I do know the answer. It's within me. I have to quiet the noise so I can hear.
Yes. Yes. And everything will be all right. It will, when our heart voice gets strong, when we have powerful, when we've got a lot of heart voice power, then we are able to trust in all outcomes. Mm-hmm. And that eliminates the worry. It eliminates the fear. When we have that level of power, we can enjoy what we're doing right here, right now, and trust in all outcomes. And trust that even when shit happens, we'll figure it out.
I love that.
Because we will.
Yeah, I love that. I love that. I love this connection. Can I ask you, where can people best connect with you? I'll make sure everything's in your show notes, but where's the best place for people to follow, connect, and learn more about the work that you're doing?
I would say two places. My website is lizlongwrites.com. Also, I also have victimtown.com. So if that's easier to remember, that'll also take you to the same place. And you can sign up if you want to stay in touch. I do send out an email. It's really sporadic. It's really small. Sometimes it's every 6 weeks. Sometimes you might get two in a month. It's inconsistent and it won't bombard your inbox. And on social media, you can find me at Navigating Shitstorms.
Love that. That's the best name ever. It's the best name. Well, I love this conversation with you, Liz. I have a question for you, and it is my last question that I always ask. It is, what lesson in life are you most grateful for?
Lesson in life. The thing that I'm most grateful for today is learning to love myself. And that took almost 60 years. Yeah. But that's the one thing that has changed everything. And I think that's our purpose, because we all get messed up with our childhoods. We all get messed up with other experiences. That's unavoidable. And I think if we do nothing with our more in our entire lives, then come back to ourselves and love who we are, then our lives have meaning, because that's everything.
That's beautiful. That is beautiful. I love that message. I love everything that you've shared. I can't wait to dive into your book. And I just thank you for sharing your story, your journey with us, and what you have come through, because I know that it will land and support somebody who's listening today.
Oh, that's really great to hear. It's been so fun and such a pleasure to chat with you. And thanks again for having me.
Absolutely. Thank you so much for tuning in to another episode of Own Your Choices, Own Your Life. If you love this episode, I invite you to tag me on social media with your takeaways or share it with a friend. Please, if you feel called, take 30 seconds to leave a 5-star review, and I will be forever grateful.
Until next time, remember, when you own your choices, you truly own your life.